Hello to our viewers. Today is a really very special day because we have Deborah Grassman on the show today, who is probably the best, most experienced guru of caring for veterans in hospice care that we could have. So welcome, Deborah.
Well, thank you so much, Tina. I appreciate those accolades.
Oh my goodness. It's just very humbling, and I could not tell you if I could pick anybody in this whole country to speak to these kinds of topics about caring for veterans, and then of course your new project, Soul Injury, it would be you. So let me give everybody just a little background on Deborah first.
Very humbled.
So Deborah is the founder of Opus Peace, a nonprofit 501c3 organization whose mission is to provide education and training programs that respond to soul injury. She's a nurse practitioner and worked for the Department of Veteran Affairs, Bay Pines VA healthcare system for 30 years, directing the hospice and palliative care program and caring for 10,000 dying veterans. Her books, Peace at Last, Stories of Hope, and Healing for Veterans and the Hero Within, Redeeming the Destiny We Were Born to Fulfill. These books reveal the lessons learned about attaining inner peace. And ironically, these lessons have come from people trained for war. So I have played Deborah's video, Wounded Warrior, The Last Battle, I can't even count the times. And it is so amazing how you have been able to put together things for people like me that work in hospice that help us understand the different conflicts, the different effects the different conflicts have on veterans, and how people in hospice care can best help a veteran that's dying. So before we get into Soul Injury and Opus Peace, if you could give everybody just a little background on your experiences and the things that you've learned caring for 10,000 dying veterans.
Well, certainly you can appreciate being in hospice, how that changes your life. And then you add on to that taking care of traumatized people. And in some ways, I believe that it's the confluence of both of the patient populations that is yielding lessons for the world. Certainly, you can appreciate that as people are coming to the end of their lives and they're getting ready to meet their maker, so to speak, that things that they thought they should or should not have done often surface and regrets surface. And certainly what I have seen is that many of those regrets surface what they did in combat. It might be, you know, killing other people, killing people they should not have killed, such as civilians or children. Those things just linger. And often throughout their lifetime, they will tend to kind of suppress those and numb those memories out. But when they're on their deathbed, so to speak, those memories can often surface. And what they need help with is being able to mourn those losses and be able to learn how to forgive themselves and forgive others for the things they've done or not done. They carry a lot of survivor's guilt oftentimes. Mm-hmm. The other thing that they are indoctrinated in the military culture is to be very stoic, to be very strong, and to keep on this, you know, kind of I'm fine veneer all their lives, which keeps this trauma, which keeps this unmourned loss and unforgiven guilt and shame kind of locked up. And then for all of us, as we're coming to the end of our lives, our conscious mind gets weaker and our unconscious mind gets stronger. So that's when these memories tend to surface, is at that time. And it's important that we in hospice or family members or whoever's around this dying veteran who might be expressing these things, to not say things like, oh, you were just following orders, being a good soldier, doing your duty. those kinds of things. Because what we're really saying to them then is, you know, don't tell me about your guilt and shame and pain, you know, stuff them behind that stoic wall yet again.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's all about us in hospice and long-term care facilities or family members. It's knowing how to create a safe emotional environment so those stories can come out if they so choose. Now, having said that, it's important not to push them to tell their stories, because I think we can do damage if we do that.
And I know my former father-in-law was a World War II Air Force. He was an alcoholic, and terrible situations in the family when he would start drinking and he'd start talking about it, or PTSD would, you know, there was one, they were at a party and he thought the host was a German soldier. I mean, all these horrible memories. And so oftentimes the family's afraid to bring it up for fear of what will happen. And, but then at the end of life, it's so important that they, I don't know. I mean, you're the expert. You tell me, like, how do you deal with those complicated family dynamics?
Well, the advantage in hospice is you have approaching death on your side, so to speak. You know, prior to that, they may not be so motivated to heal these things or to face these things. But at the end of life, often what I see, what rises, I call the unvarnished truth. So if you have family members, if you're going to, our clinicians as ourselves, the first thing that has to happen is we can't be afraid of what you just said. We can't be afraid of opening that can of worms. We can't be afraid of our own unmourned losses that we may hold. So in a lot of ways, it's about we as clinicians have to kind of do our own inner work first. Otherwise, you're right. We get scared and we'll shut that patient down, or, you know, tell them not to cry or whatever, all the things that you're not supposed to do. So the first thing is for us to become at peace with the turmoil that's in the world and the turmoil that's in that patient, that's in that bed that we are caring for. So that's how I would answer that primarily. And then it's encouraging that patient to, you know, asking that patient, inviting the story, and letting the patient control how much or how little they will want to reveal.
And I shared that you have one favorite story that I love, so please do share that one.
Yes.
You have a lot of stories I love, but I really love this one.
Well, this is a patient who was on a medical unit. His doctor asked me to come see him for a hospice consult. And when I got there, it was clear to me that he only had, you know, a day or so to live. I call these hospice codes because they're kind of like emergencies. And we may not be doing CPR on them, but there's a lot of things we have to do urgently if that patient's going to have peace. He was a World War II veteran. And so I asked him if there was anything from that war that might still be troubling him now. And he nodded his head, yes. I asked him if he would want to tell me about that. And he nodded his head, yes. But then he added that he was too ashamed to say it out loud. So he motioned for me to come down toward his pillow. And this is what he whispered in my ear. He said, "Do you have any idea how many men I have killed?" And I just shook my head. You know, that is one of those sacred moments you do not want to corrupt with words. And then he said, "Do you have any idea how many throats I've slit?" Again, I just shook my head no. And we sat in silence, sharing that man's suffering for a long time together. And at length, I asked him if it would be meaningful if I said a prayer asking for forgiveness. And he shook his head, yes. So I placed my hand firmly on his heart, and I prayed something pretty close to this. "Dear God, this man comes before you acknowledging the pain he has caused others. He has killed. He has maimed. He hurts with the pain of knowing he did this. He hurts with the pain of humanity. He comes before you now asking for forgiveness. He needs your mercy to restore his integrity. He comes before you saying, "Forgive me for the wrongs I have committed." Dear God, help him feel your saving grace. Restore this man to wholeness so he can come home to you soon. This man kept his eyes closed throughout that prayer, but tears were streaming down his face. And when he did open his eyes, this big smile came. It was almost palpable how much lighter he felt. It was such evidence to me of just how heavy shame weighs. Now, I mentioned placing my hand on his heart. And there's a reason why I do that. And when you asked earlier about what can family members do when they're asking these questions, we call this the anchoring heart technique. So I want you to think about when you're calm and relaxed, your energy's down here, way low in your belly. When you get anxious and upset, your energy's up here. And what we often do when we get bad news, we'll actually gasp and we'll go,
right.
We'll grab ourselves here.
Exactly.
Why do we do that? Because it anchors us in our own skin so we don't disappear or disassociate or numb out automatically, but it helps to keep us in our skin. So I often teach family members, because, you know, at the end of life, they always want to do something.
Sure.
Usually what they're doing is sticking food in their mouth all the way to the very end, right? So what I usually say at that point is I'll say, you know, that's not going to really help right now. His needs are changing. And I tell them why that's not going to help. And I say, let me show you something that will really help. And then I show them how they can place their hand firmly on their loved one's chest. And then that's step one. Step two is to breathe deeply, because that's what keeps us in the present moment. Breathing deeply, it helps us kind of move that energy down, back down into our bellies instead of way up here. And then the last thing is really to let ourselves feel whatever it is we're feeling, whatever we don't want to feel oftentimes, right?
Yeah.
There's no purpose for doing it. So it's being able to feel that fear, being able to feel that shame, being able to feel that emotional pain. Because as we can do that, then the fear of those things can dissipate.
I was going to say that it seems like that's what allows it to be released.
That's what allows it to be released. It allows the fear to be released. And as bad as the pain and shame is, the fear of it is more, because right. The fear of it drives us into numbing behaviors. And those numbing behaviors end up separating us from ourselves. And that's a soul injury. When we get separated from our own sense of self, when we kind of lose our identity and who we think we are, then that's the soul injury that oftentimes we would see that would emerge on veterans' deathbeds.
Right. Perfect, perfect segue, because I do want to get into your new project, relatively new project. And so I know you just described soul injury, but the first question is, what is a soul injury? So if you can give it to us just one more time, because we're now going to get into Opus Peace, soul injury. So tell us, what is soul injury and what is Opus Peace?
Well, as I said, soul injury is any time that we get separated from our own sense of self and how we perceive our own identity. And oftentimes what then perpetuates the soul injury, we have identified three things. The first being unmourned loss. Second is unforgiven guilt and shame. And the third is diminished self-compassion. So oftentimes what happens is, you know, we experience some kind of loss. We get separated from our own sense of self and we kind of banish that part of ourself out into unconsciousness. So it's about being able to reown that self and then create a safe place within our own inner being that part of self come back home. Now, most of us have not slit throats like the story I told you earlier, but many people, for example, have been bullied. They've been called names. And oftentimes as children, we will actually incorporate that label, that name into our own identity. Mm-hmm. If we do that, that's the start of a soul injury.
Oh my goodness.
Stop wanting to be who we are. And we start looking out here wanting to be someone else and wishing we weren't us and those types of things. And oftentimes when you hear people's story, especially in middle age or more, it's often them recovering from the soul injury that occurred, you know, years before. So these soul injuries in my mind are very, very powerful. Now with our combat veterans, there's kind of a subcategory of soul. We see soul injury as a broad category. There's a subcategory of what's called moral injury.
That moral?
Is moral.
Okay.
M-O-A-L, moral injury, and that's well identified in the literature. In the Department of Defense and the VA, they talk about moral injury, which is a subcategory of soul injury. And the story I told you earlier is a perfect example of a moral injury. We've extrapolated what we have learned from veterans and their moral injuries to see, because when we would listen to their stories on their deathbed, the moral injury they sustained in combat was very big. But there were lots of others, and oftentimes the other injuries, inner injuries, had occurred way before they ever went into the military, and or happened after they left, especially if they use a lot of numbing agents mm-hmm. to try to block out those memories. Then the numbing agents that they used caused havoc in families, much like you described in your family.
Right.
And therefore, and they feel guilty about that. They don't like doing that to their families, and then they feel guilty about that, and they get further separate. Well, those are soul injuries. And so, as I said, part of what we're wanting to do, when veterans come to the end of their lives, often a lot of perspective emerges, insight emerges, and wisdom emerges in a few weeks of life. And so what we've tried to do is take lessons that they learned and then communicated to us and we witnessed for ourselves and be able to take that to the world. So there were actually six of us that left the VA in order to start Opus Peace, our nonprofit organization.
And I just want to make sure everybody knows the website is Opus, spelled O-P-U-S, peace.org.
Yes, peace.org, or you can go to soulinjury.org. Either one will take you to the same website. So at any rate, we started that organization specifically so that we could take this message forward. So we do have programs for veterans and first responders, and we have programs for, you know, non-veterans, you know, again, so that we can all achieve that personal healing. So the mission of Opus Peace is to provide programs that respond to soul injury. So for example, we have what we call a fallen comrade ceremony that is specifically for veterans who can lay down their burdens in just a two-hour ceremony, and they have a profound impact. We also include the family members. And we also include, and this is crucial, civilians, so that civilians can know how to create a safe environment. We can teach them, they can witness for themselves what happens when you can learn how to be with them, veterans in their pain, and also be able to provide opening for them to forgive themselves. Another ceremony we've created is...
Can I just ask a question? So are all of those people in the same ceremony, or are there separate ones for...
They're all in the same ceremony.
All in the same.
Ceremony. The reason we wanted it just in 2 hours is so often you can't get a veteran to come to a program for a day or a weekend or an eight-week program. They just, especially if they have PTSD, so we thought, we've got to get this compacted down into 2 hours or so, because... Honestly, what we did was we said, you know, a wife can probably drag her veteran husband to a two-hour ceremony. So honestly, that is how it has occurred. I say wife and husbands, but we've certainly had a lot of women veterans. In fact, the president of our Opus Peace Board is a Vietnam veteran herself.
Okay.
So at any rate, this applies to women as well. The other ceremony we've designed is a soul restoration caregiver ceremony designed specifically for healthcare professionals who work in burnout-rich environments, such as hospice, where you're inundated with death and grieving every day. You know, ER, ICU, crime investigators, you know, if you work for the Department of Children and Family Services, those types of workers all are at high risk for unmourned loss because, you know, you'll be in this intense situation, sad situation, then you walk out of there, man, you have to walk into another one and, you know, you don't have time. And in addition to being a clinician for 30 years, for 27 out of those 30 years, I was also an administrator, a supervisor, and a director. And, you know, early on, I was able to pay a lot of attention to the hospice workers' need for support and what have you. But as time went on, what I found is that that started getting squeezed out amidst all the other government requirements and, you know, all sorts of things that kind of squeeze that out. So I was getting frustrated at seeing my workers not be able to have the environment. And I realized, you know, that's sort of an ethical dilemma. If we know we're putting an employee in a burnout rich environment and we're not doing things to help them with that, then that's sort of an unethical position for a supervisor to be in.
And let me just interrupt one second. Our listeners and viewers are caregivers, meaning somebody caring for a loved one, but then also medical professionals. So I'm thrilled to hear you speak about a program specifically for them.
Exactly. We have actually two programs, one's for personal caregivers and one is for professional caregivers. So we absolutely respond. In there's a lot of overlap in that. There's some specific concerns in healthcare professionals that personal professionals don't have to deal with, if it's going from one patient to another. And there's a lot of personal issues, personal caregiving issues that professionals don't have to deal with.
Right.
For example, personal caregivers are there 24 hours a day and they never get a break and they never, whereas professional caregivers can kind of leave a situation and start fresh with the next one. So, I mean, there's a lot of different dynamics. But at any rate, my point being that we have designed a program and again, compacted it into a 1.5 hour program where caregivers can truly come and identify those losses, have those losses validated, and then release those losses, and also learn how to do that, and also learn how to be reconnected with their own vitality when they do that.
And are these ceremonies in Florida, or do you have people around the country that do them, or?
We've done them all over the country because what we do here in Florida actually is we have an institute whereby we train what we call ambassadors in how to do this and how to go forth and do this. So the ambassadors are trained in both how to implement both of these ceremonies. They are trained in how to provide presentations on soul injury and presentations on unmourned loss and presentations on forgiveness. So we right now have 88 ambassadors throughout the country.
Wonderful. And you've only been, is it about a year and a half or how long?
Well, we've been in existence for 4 years.
4 years, okay.
We've been doing the trainings, though, for a year and a half. We have another training coming up October 2nd through the 5th.
Great.
Another one in February. And we usually have about 35 to 40 people that come for the training. And so really our primary mission right now to multiply the effect is really to train others. That's now I still travel, as you may know, and do a lot of these myself, but we recognize that I'm a limited source. And so it's much better.
It'd be great if we could clone you. I know I'm hearing something on the news about they're doing all kinds of fabulous stuff with genes and things. It'd be great if we could have a bunch of Deborah Grassmans out there.
I want to tell you, I sort of tear up. I can't tell you what it's like to watch these ambassadors go out there and they're doing what I have been doing. They're doing what they are implementing, I always tell them, I said, you know, what you're getting is not Deborah Grassman. What you are getting is what 10,000 veterans, dying veterans, taught Deborah Grassman. And when you see them, I'm telling you, they are out there, and I have seen them. I have witnessed, they are as good or better than me, because they bring their own flavor, their own perspective in their own indigenous, you know, community or agency. And so, I mean, I can't tell you the fulfillment. I had fulfillment doing 30 years of work with veterans. And now I'm fortunate to be getting fulfillment from these ambassadors. And
well, That's your legacy. You're going to live on for long past your journey here on this planet.
Well, as I said, I just don't, you know, when people die, they take that knowledge, that wisdom with them. And, you know, the six of us, and I want to acknowledge, you know, this isn't just about Deborah Grassman. I mean, that's why we have Opus Peace. And the word opus means, you know, masterpiece. It's a work. And you're probably familiar with the term in music. And it often means a composer's masterpiece, you know, and often a very complex work of art, so to speak. But it's really true of anybody who has completed some type of life work. And so when we talk about how to attain peace, you know, we're not just talking about peace, okay, nothing bad's happened today, okay, I feel pretty. We're talking about a peace that goes not just in your head and not just in your heart, but all the way down into your soul. That takes work. And so what we found, and because we had to be in a very compressed time frame with dying people, because we didn't have the luxury of, you know, months or even years to help them. We had, you know, our average length of stay at our inpatient hospice was 9 days. That was average. So we had a lot of veterans that died in 2 or 3 days. So we're on that, you know, very compressed timeline. And so they taught us some things about how to do things to get to that bottom line very quickly without wasting time. And although I have to say, you know, again, death was on our side, because that makes, I always say, dying people are fertile ground for healing. And there's a reason why. And that's because death awakens us to the idea that our life matters. You know, the day before you're given a terminal diagnosis, you take your life for granted.
Sure.
After you're given a terminal diagnosis, you wake up that your life matters. And you're much more open to, you know, taking in things that you didn't, that you used to not take in.
That reminds me of that country song, Live Like You're Dying. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're dying, then every single day, every single hour matters.
Exactly. And that doesn't mean, oh, you just do whatever you want. It's actually finding meaning in ways that are much beyond just, oh, let's live for the day and have fun only, you know, for today. Living in the present moment and living like life matters is much more than that. But that's another topic.
Right.
We'll get into that.
I know it. And I could talk to you for about 50 hours nonstop. I want to just make sure I'm covering a couple other things before we're done. General questions, why should we be concerned with soul injury, and how can we help people with soul injury? So you may have touched on some of those programs that are on your website, but just to try to kind of wrap up, that's kind of the crux of this talk, is if you could just kind of summarize, why do we need to recognize it, and how can we help people that have recognized this is what's going on?
Well, I think I've already sort of described the how. Let me explain the why. The reason why we should be addressing it is because the treatment for soul injury is different than post-traumatic stress disorder or, you know, stress, secondary stress. The treatment involves learning how to grieve those unmourned losses, learning how to forgive ourselves and others, and learning how to extend self-compassion to ourselves. Now, my question is, where do we learn that? Do you learn that in any healthcare curriculum? I don't care whether it's nursing, physician, you know, social worker, whatever it might be. Chaplains might, in their, you know, they may have some of this. But for the most part, healthcare curriculums do not address it. So for the first thing, how I would answer that is the reason we need to be addressing it is because we have not been taught. It is not part of healthcare curriculums. And in our view, it should be an essential part. If you think of loss, we often, especially in a hospice context, we often think of it just surrounding death and the family's death afterward and bereavement. But loss starts with the diagnosis.
Right.
start, anytime a patient is coming into a hospital, a doctor's office, there is some kind of loss of health that they're, unless it's preventative health, there is some kind of loss of health. That's the reason they're coming in. And rather than, you know, ignoring the loss that they have experienced, and if it's, you know, a terminal diagnosis, or if it's a chronic diagnosis, such as multiple sclerosis or autism, I mean, there's, you know, any chronic, that's a loss, and it's a loss that's going to last a long time. And that's what we call an insidious soul injury. So you have traumatic soul injuries, like I described with our combat veterans, and of course, any trauma acutely, but you have what we call insidious soul injuries that end up kind of robbing us of ourselves. We get separated from ourselves gradually over time. And in some ways, that can be even more difficult because we don't recognize it. Another thing, you know, traumatic soul injury, we know because, you know, you come back from war changed. You're a different person. Or if you've been raped, you know, the day before the rape, you're one way, and the day after the rape, you are changed, and changed forever if you don't address that. So acute situations with trauma are often easy to see. Now, just because you've been traumatized does not mean that you sustain a soul injury. You attain a soul injury if the trauma causes you to get separated from your own sense of self, and not all traumatic injuries do that. Insidious soul injuries, as I said, can be more gradual, and so we don't recognize that we've sort of lost ourselves until you get all the way to the end, and it's like, oh my gosh, how did this happen? Well, it happened little by little.
Right. Interesting.
So why we should be addressing this is because we need to learn how to grieve, how to forgive, and how to extend self-compassion. What I know for sure is that our society is blatantly afraid of emotional pain. We are taught not how to lose, how to fail. What we are taught is how to gain, how to control, how to hold on to. So there is no place that teaches us how to grieve, how to let go.
So wow.
Why we need to be having this conversation that
exactly
about soul injury.
So tell our viewers the best, maybe there's more ways than one, the best way to connect with you, your work, your website, your trainers, all that.
Well, we actually have a new website that's getting ready to be launched, and it is very comprehensive and gives all that information, and it's opuspeace.org, opuspeace.org, or soulinjury.org. That's probably the best way. It has a little contact button. And you can always contact us personally, and myself or my co-founder, one of us will see that and respond. The second way, which would be more involved, is, of course, to come to the Institute for the training. And it's a four-day training where we will give you the skills to do this. And more importantly, we give you all the PowerPoints, all the songs, all everything that you can then go out. So you don't have to reinvent the wheel. You don't have to. We will give you all of the material that you can do. A third way is simply to use my books.
Yes, please share those.
Well, here's the one that most people will use. There are book communities throughout the country. This is the most popular book, The Hero Within, because it applies to the broad population and is really applicable to everybody. Peace at Last is the other one. It's more geared strictly for veterans and their families. But the point being, I think, you know, as important as I think the books are, obviously I'm biased about that, but more important than the books is the books serve as a vehicle to achieve a community of people where they can dissipate that fear of emotional pain, where they can come together with that in that common unity that we all have together and facing our demons, so to speak. And we found it to be very, very powerful. Another thing you can do is go online. We have a petition before Congress to declare January as National Soul Injury Awareness Month.
Wow, that's awesome.
Well, we truly are on a mission to start a movement. I mean, it's certainly already started and it is gaining steam. So we are starting a movement to raise awareness about soul injury. And our ultimate goal, which is quite ambitious, is to actually get it into the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, or the ICD code, so that we can start recognizing, having conversations about it. The film that you mentioned that you saw recently was produced by Hospice Foundation of America and Opus Peace. And the whole idea of that film is to give agencies an easy platform in that film to take it out into their community and to their agency to start the conversation. So it's an hour and a half film, and it's followed by a half hour, you know, the local agency or community gets a panel together to answer questions and what have you after the film is over. And then you can get two CEs from Hospice Foundation of America. That's the easiest way. I mean, they have a whole kit, so it gives you how to PR it, you do the public relations invitations, posters, you get 15 soul, ask me about soul injury buttons, and it's a whole kit so that agencies don't have to do anything other than kind of implement the kit. And the other thing, it comes with a manual that covers a lot of the stuff we talked about, but one of the things that I think is most important is I actually have 12 insight activities. And if you just take one insight each month and implement it within your own life or your agency,
mm-hmm.
it can change a culture
of right.
It really can. So all of that comes in one package. So that's probably the easiest and the best way to implement this information.
That's wonderful. And I love the fact that this is a movement, and I do hope that you get awarded this January Soul Injury Month recognition, because this whole telesummit is about taking the fear out of conversations about advanced care planning. It's okay to talk about it. Just because you talk about it doesn't mean you're going to catch something. End-of-life care and taking the fear out of talking and recognizing I've got a soul injury, and it's important that I address that. Mm-hmm. So, I just think, and the thing that broke my heart when you first mentioned it was when you mentioned the bullying as a young child. I mean, how many kids are bullied? Mm-hmm. And how many people get over it, but then how many people take that forward in their life? It's just heartbreaking to even think about.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
So, it's wonderful, wonderful work. Deborah, you are amazing. I'm going to try not to tear up because I just think you're fabulous. And sorry. This has been a real honor. And I know you're going to just continue to train and spread your good word and all that wonderful knowledge that all those fabulous veterans passed on to you.
Well, it was a privilege taking care of those veterans, and I can say now it's a privilege to be training these ambassadors who are so motivated to help others and be change agents. So
yeah.
You know, truly a privilege for me, and I thank you that you're interested in this topic and you've given me this opportunity, Tina. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. My heartfelt pleasure. And I know the listeners and the viewers are just going to be changed. I feel like they will be changed for sure.
I hope so. That's my desire.
Yes. Yes. So thank you so very much.
You're very welcome.
Okay.